Hey everybody, it's Kate.
And Devin.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
Here we are again.
Pick. I love hearing what you guys want to hear.
Yeah.
It's the best.
And it's cool to see it almost like duel it out. Do this one. Do that one.
Well, exactly. It's so cool. And also, like, again, what our Patreons want, they totally they get.
Which is why you should become a Patreon.
Yeah, if you're not already.
Putting that plug up first before last.
If you're not already, like, you just got to do it. I love doing these Patreon picks because it's just a great way to involve our Patreons a little bit in the content.
Add some to the benefit of what being part of our family is.
Our Patreon fam.
Hi, guys.
I love the fall, so I am just like perpetually and just like a very cool mood.
I know, right?
It's just such a vibe, and I'm really loving it.
So my son said to me, so I think it was about a week and a half ago, I started putting some up of my fall decorations. And I did a little bit one day, and he said, Mommy, what are you doing? And I said, I'm decorating for fall. And then the next day, I'm putting out some more sweater pumpkins or whatever. And he says, Mommy, what are you doing? And I said, I'm decorating for fall. Bless his three-year-old heart. He said, again?
Does this ever stop, mother?
No.
For Devin, spoiler alert, it does not stop.
No.
And it just continues until it's time to decorate for a different season or holiday.
I told him, I said, just wait till Christmas, buddy.
Devin is kind of a professional decorator of holidays.
No.
Yes. No. Devin, your home, like on Christmas, like Thanksgiving, like around the holidays, is just like, there's nowhere else I'd rather be. I just want to like get
over
on your couch. She's got like this little fireplace. I just want to like snuggle on your couch, like
with the fireplace,
with the
going,
fire running, with like the lights down
the
and
lights
all the
over
lights,
the mantle,
like the Christmas lights, like twinkling. And I just want to like drink hot chocolate in your living room forever. God. Devin is a vibe. She's kind of like a Christmas queen.
That's our holiday vibe. Now we're going to get into like some Med Crime Bastard vibe.
So the Patreon pick that won was this devil of a man by the name of David Kwiatkowski. And I remember learning about him years ago because he is where he was caught is actually right here in our home state of New Hampshire.
A local.
Yeah, so it's got such a local element for us. So I remember reading about this.
I remember this too.
And hearing about this, and it garnered, you know, national news. There's stuff from Newsweek and USA Today and all sorts of stuff that I was finding on him.
Right in here, our home state.
I cannot believe that this happened.
I hate him.
What he did? Oh, he's awful. It's
I don't
terrible.
Know all the details, but I remember the gist of the headlines when it was in the news.
Oh, it's ridiculous what this guy did.
I can't wait for you to Debbie Down me.
I will. Don't you worry. So let's dive right in, shall we?
He was a travel nurse, right?
So he wasn't a nurse. He was a radiologist.
Oh, that's right.
Technologist,
but he traveled.
But he was a traveler. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So we will get into the nitty-gritty of all of that. This whole thing is like kind of cool because it's a little bit more like sciencey and medical and technical, and so we get to talk about all the procedures and the medications and get to bring it back to the sciencey roots. So it's pretty cool. So David Kwiatkowski, he was a radiologic technologist who infected at least 46 known patients with hepatitis C, and he actually directly influenced and caused the death of at least one person. And we will get into the hows and whys sort of further down the line.
So my first, and again, you're going to say, Devin, you're getting ahead of yourself.
You are. I know you are.
My
but go ahead.
My first part is, how does a radiological tech, who have a very important job, but how did they, like, inject, you know what I mean? Like,
oh, we'll get into it.
But then I'm like, wait, dyes,
yes.
IVs. See it? So I get it.
Yeah.
Oh, and I don't like them
already. I know. It's crazy. So, and then the story was kind of tough because he's another guy that there's not like a bunch of info in one place. Like no one's like written a book about this guy or anything. Right. So, I went through so many like news articles from around the time, and then like as his legal battle kind of ensued, and then there was a little bit of news lately on him too. But I finally came across this big piece.
I think I've missed that.
Yeah, not real lately, but in 2021, you know, fairly recent.
Yeah.
So I finally found this great piece that the Boston Globe did on him shortly after he was arrested and like the fallout that was coming. It was before he was sentenced, but it was really helpful because he went to so many different hospitals in so many different states that it was hard to like, you know, really paint a picture of what was going on. But that Boston Globe piece was great. So I'm going to link that in the show notes.
I would imagine the jumping around of the travel industry that it is made it hard to pinpoint.
Oh, it did.
And like make a pattern.
Absolutely.
Right?
And I think that is what he used to his advantage, because as you'll see, it's like he would raise some suspicion and then be out of there.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then on to the next and on to the next. And it's a growing pattern with all these cases that we do that, you know, there's very little follow-up, you know, as people go place to place. And even with these staffing agencies, it's crazy that he got away with it as long as he did.
Right.
It really is.
It's really, that's upsetting.
It's wild. So, as always, we're going to begin with his early life. So David Kwiatkowski, he was born in Canton, Michigan in 1980. Canton is a suburban, like middle-class suburb. It's right outside of Detroit. So lived like really in sort of like the immediate Detroit area. Now, his father worked as a supervisor for an auto plant, and his mom was a stay-at-home mom. The family was actually really well known in the community for being like the athletic family.
Oh.
Yeah. So there were four boys. David was obviously one of them. He was the second oldest. And they all were so heavily into sports, mainly football and baseball. Mm-hmm. And baseball was like huge in this family. They all were huge sports fans as well. And their dad coached a lot of their teams like growing up when they were little and even into like middle school and high school. He was really involved in the coaching. And then their mom like attended every game and just sounds like she was a really cool, supportive like sports mom.
I wonder if he got upset with his dad with some of the coaching, like my dad.
Yeah.
Like, no, wait, he was an umpire. Tangent. My father was an umpire and struck me out, and when he's listening, I'm real still upset about that, Dad.
She's furrowing her eyebrow.
So when you listen to this,
Devin's dad, you guys need to talk about this. There's some energy here. So it sounded like everybody was really happy. You know, they had a really, really healthy focus with baseball and with everything that they did. The boys had a reputation for being like a little rowdy, but it never
as boys do.
Yeah, but it never was like excessive. They never got in a lot of trouble. The neighbors just knew them to be like kind of loud and like, you know, teenage and preteen
probably
boys.
Probably athletic, always wrestling
with
each other.
Yes, exactly. Always just like, you know, doing stupid shit, but never really like got in trouble with the law. They were all good kids. Mm-hmm. And they all did really well in school. And they were very big Detroit Tigers fans, and they went to a lot of games with their dad, and that was like their big thing. They all played varsity baseball in high school as well for Canton High School. And David's position was a catcher, and he was reportedly like really good at what he did. Mm-hmm. One of his brothers was a pitcher, so he would recall that they would go out in the yard and just like
always
practice
do it
for
yeah,
hours,
that's
you know?
Great.
And then as he got a little older, David started gaining this reputation among his friends for like his exaggerated storytelling. So some of his high school friends would start to say that he tended to like exaggerate things to make up like these grandiose stories and make him seem like more interesting and cool, which is like kind of lame. But I feel like a lot of kids probably, you know, do this
you
to an extent.
You don't need to do it. You're cool enough already.
No, I mean, it sounds like you're pretty cool.
Just who you are.
He always talked about wanting to become a, quote, big time doctor, end quote, and that he wanted to like grow up and make a ton of money and leave this place and travel and have, you know, a million wives and whatever. He also seemed like he was quite the charmer. He did very well with the ladies, even through high school. And he bragged often about, quote, talking himself out of tons of traffic tickets, end quote. So he was like a bragger and like really
come on, buddy.
Thought pretty highly of himself. Now, he graduated high school and he moves on to start studying at Madonna University, which is in Livonia, which is very close by. It's like another suburb of Detroit, so all in that same area. He had a genuine interest in health sciences, and he actually went on to study healthcare administration. He went part-time, so he definitely took his time to finish, but he finally finished his bachelor's degree after about 7 years.
Okay.
And right after that, he enrolled straight into a 2-year program again at Madonna for a radiologic technologist. And he graduated, he did that full-time, and then he became a certified radiologic technologist.
Good for him.
So for those who are not familiar, because there's a couple of different titles, and people might have heard the term like x-ray tech, ultrasound tech, you know, mm-hmm. but they all do have actually very different roles. So there's several different like types of technologists and technicians within the radiology field, and they all have sort of their specialized field of study. So like there's an ultrasound tech who really only specializes in doing ultrasonography, mm-hmm. x-ray techs, which is different than a radiologic technologist. X-ray techs do x-rays, and they do a lot with x-rays, but then there's like the echocardiography techs, the MRI technologists, they mm-hmm. all are highly specialized as well.
The scans.
I know. Mm. And then the radiologic technologist specifically works by using x-ray and CT imaging to mm-hmm. obtain advanced images of specific organs and systems in the body. And they also do assist with procedures that are performed by radiologists. So they will routinely access IVs to give contrast mm-hmm. and dye, like you said, for studies that they perform.
Make the fluorescence on some of those procedures.
Exactly, and that's how they see all the different tissues and all the vessels and such. Now, it's an ever-growing field, and there are roles in inpatient hospital settings, doctor's offices, operating rooms during surgeries, mm-hmm. and specialized procedure rooms such as cardiac cath labs. And we'll mm-hmm. talk about that specifically in a little bit more detail later on. Because we'll see that he ends up in one of these cath labs.
Now I go, what did he do?
Yeah, he did some stuff. So radiologic technologists are different from a radiologist as well, in that a radiologist is a physician who specializes in interpreting all of these tests and make diagnoses based
really
on them.
Really looking at the picture of right. the test that
and
the tech performed.
Stating, like, this is what's going on.
And making a diagnosis
yeah,
from
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly. And they also perform procedures that require imaging guidance. Most radiologic technologists, though, can probably interpret these studies as well or better than some radiologists.
Sometimes, yeah.
Because that's just what they do all day, mm-hmm. every day, and they mm-hmm. get very good at what they do.
Yeah.
At this point, he's in his mid-20s. He's in sort of this period of transition of launching into adulthood, which was kind of a tough one for him. He starts working in a few like local hospitals, but nothing really clicked, and he kind of like jumped place to place initially. So something about David was that he suffered from Crohn's disease. So Crohn's disease is a chronic autoimmune condition in which the mm-hmm. immune system creates an inflammatory response within the lining of your GI tract. And actually, this can happen anywhere from the mouth to the anus, technically, with Crohn's disease. Most commonly.
From the mouth, really? Mm-hmm. It's not just in the intestinal region?
Nope. Hmm. And most commonly in the small and large intestine is where it occurs. But technically, it can affect anything in the GI tract. And it's a disease that often requires very intense medications such as steroids and immunotherapies to control. Mm-hmm. It tends to sort of come and go in these flares. So when it flares, it sort of causes all of these ulcers and inflammation within the intestinal tract, which then cause nausea, intense abdominal pain, diarrhea, rectal bleeding. It's awful.
It'll stay dormant for a while. Mm-hmm. And then
it can kind of
something triggers, whether an illness
or something
food,
you eat. Yes. Yep.
Can
absolutely.
Just make it like make your intestines swell up and cause all those symptoms.
Oh, it's awful. And people with Crohn's sometimes end up with surgical repairs of their intestinal tracts and at mm-hmm. time need ostomies and removal of entire portions of the intestine or colon due to the friable tissue rupturing or causing infections. It can be mm-hmm. very serious. It can be life-threatening if it progresses to that.
Right.
So very soon, he starts having run-ins with the law due to alcohol and drugs.
Oh.
So his doctors had...
As a young adult?
Yes. So this is in like his mid-20s. His doctors had prescribed him opiate pain medicine to help with the chronic abdominal pain that comes with Crohn's. and he was quickly noted to be asking for refills way too early. And it was, he was put on like a pain contract, meaning that, you know, that the prescribing office is very closely monitoring the patient's use of the medicine and will not issue a refill early until like the day or so before they are due for the refill.
We gave you 30 pills to take one a day. We're not giving it to you before day 28 or 29.
Exactly.
Yes.
And if you ask for a refill early, they say no. Mm-hmm. But, and I've seen this in some of my patient notes where, I mean, this happens everywhere, where people will try to like manipulate the system.
Of course.
And often come up with these crazy excuses as to why they've lost their medicines and they need a refill right now. Like sometimes, hey, somebody stole my purse with my medicine in it. So doctor's offices now have a way around that where they require a police report as proof. Like you have to give me a police report that it was actually stolen prior to refilling that in that situation.
And then sometimes too, they, they'll drug test.
Oh yeah,
before
they will.
They refill.
Absolutely.
You
yes.
know, they want to actually see a certain level in your system.
Right.
That would show that you're actually taking it as prescribed.
And that you're not abusing anything else. Right.
Have you ever wanted to hear the story behind some of the most compelling hauntings in history?
I know I have.
From Amityville to The Conjuring, the Grave Talks podcast takes you there.
Oh, I love that podcast.
Three times a week, Tony Bruschi, host of The Grave Talks, talks to the people who experience shocking paranormal phenomena firsthand. He dives into how the experience affected those who survived it and how it made them who they are today.
It's fascinating, you guys. He creates such a vibe.
What really happened to the Perrin family inside their haunted farmhouse? What was it like investigating side by side with Ed and Lorraine Warren as they stepped foot inside the most infamous Amityville house?
Oh my God, I love them so much.
Freaks me out.
I know.
Hear supernatural stories that you will not find anywhere else, then The Grave Talks.
I am subscribed and I love them.
Search The Grave Talks wherever you download podcasts and press subscribe.
Stat!
Then start binging away on the ghost stories no one ever thought would be told.
Such a great time for this podcast, too, with all the like creepy vibes and being September and spookiness. It's Halloween.
That is The Grave Talks. Search for it wherever you download podcasts and press subscribe today.
Stat! So, in winter 2005, he actually approached the Canton Police Department, reporting that a bunch of his prescriptions got stolen from his apartment, including all of his Crohn's medication, like his steroid, and a whole bottle of Vicodin. So when police, like, pressed him about these details, he said, look, I don't want an investigation. I just want to file a police report so you can give me a piece of paper and they will give me a new prescription. That's all I want. Which, like, somebody broke into my apartment, like, I want you to investigate that because that's fucking shady as shit. And I want to know who has access to my apartment.
Right. And so not only would you want to get your pain meds back to help control your pain, but you also need the drugs for your Crohn's that's helping to save your
life. Well, that's the thing. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But he just was concerned about the paper, which leads me to believe that he really didn't care about that.
Red flag.
Mm-hmm. So a few months later, he was seen swerving in his car and was pulled over again in Canton, at which point he failed a breathalyzer and a field sobriety test. He went to court for this and ended up paying over $1,000 in fines and had 6 months probation. And this was like the first thing that really went on his criminal record. So after this, he moves on into Detroit. And this is his very first, like, well-paying gig. And he goes to start working at Harper University Hospital. And this was in October of 2005.
Okay.
At this time, he got this job. He had already received his certification from the American Registry of Radiologic Technologists, which is, like, their certifying body. It's, like, a must-have credential to get a job. And that's the big thing that you need to show that you have a clean record for when you're enrolling in that. Mm-hmm. But because he had already enrolled and registered prior to having this record, that, like, the criminal record, the DUI arrest, it never reflected on that record, and he was able to just, like...
So they don't, like, do a new one.
Right. So he never updated the certifying body saying, hey, look, I have a criminal record now. Yeah. Nevertheless, it seems that the hospital itself did not run an actual criminal background check, because otherwise you would think, either they wouldn't have hired him or they would have at least questioned him.
That's standard in healthcare to need to pretty run one, standard. But as we've done many of these.
Yes.
Sometimes that's just
this pattern, skipped. Man. It's wild.
I know things have changed
sure.
in some drug tests now, too, but mm-hmm. you would also have to take a drug test to get hired.
That's so what that, you would think. I mean, especially
in 2005, you had to.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, that wasn't the...
I know. We'll talk about that, too.
Okay.
So, he does really well here. He's earning some good money. He bought a house in a suburb of Detroit called Westland, and he started dating and eventually became engaged to a nurse that he met there. His colleagues all actually really liked him a lot. They said he was learning really quick and he was taking well to his new role. He was like this big athletic dude, so he became like the go-to guy to help move all the big equipment and like all the big patients, and like he was like the muscles in the department.
We gotta go get David!
Let somebody go get David! We got a big person to move.
I say that a lot in my household. We need to go get David!
Somebody needs to go get David. David! So his new neighbors, actually, when he moved into his new house, also really liked him. They thought he was really helpful and really energetic. So a few months goes by and there's like a pretty abrupt and noticeable like decline in his behavior and like sort of a turn for the worse. Mm. So at work, his colleagues start noticing that he becomes more irritable and he developed like this really shitty attitude all of a sudden. He would even challenge orders from the providers, and around this time, he and his fiance broke off their relationship. So some people thought maybe he was like just going through a rough breakup or like, you know, what was going on with that. Mm-hmm. And then colleagues started noticing he would show up to work in their department like before and after working hours and on days where he was supposed to be off altogether. So this is something that hospital administrators often say is very suspicious, specifically for drug abuse and drug theft, that people will show up in their departments on off hours, which is interesting.
Less people there.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, why are you here? Mm-hmm. Why are you showing up on your off hours?
Because
you
need your fix. And if things go missing, they're not scheduled.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, shortly after, he voluntarily left his position at Harper, and his colleagues were fine with that because his attitude really sucked at that point. So they were like, bye, David.
Okay.
So September 2006, he's offered a job at University of Michigan Medical Center. And as part of hiring, they did conduct a background check and saw his 2005 DUI.
Good.
Reportedly, they responded to him an email asking more about the incident so that mm-hmm. there are, quote, not any surprises, end quote, down the road. Apparently, his response was satisfactory, whatever it was, because they did not rescind the job offer. And he did go on to work for UM Medical Center in their procedural area.
Did he disclose it? Any idea?
Well, I mean, he would have had to because, like, the records are right there.
Right, but, like, you know.
My opinion is that what probably happened is that he's very charming and he probably came up with some excuse as to, it was a really tough time for me and I made a really stupid mistake. I was battling Crohn's disease and I really overdid it. I was in a lot of pain. And like,
I was wondering if he disclosed it on his application.
Oh, that I don't know.
Before they did the background check.
That I don't know. That's a good question. So in
because sometimes that's a big no-no.
No, I know. If and then not even sometimes, it,
almost all the time.
I would imagine that he must have, because if he hadn't and then they found this, it would have been, I feel you like that would have boded really poorly for him. Watch, you know what I mean? Interview. Exactly. Yeah. So he gets hired into this procedural area. And so in procedure areas, patients will often receive sedation through an IV. And they won't necessarily be put like on a breathing tube and put under general anesthesia, but they might get something lighter called conscious sedation. So patients don't like remember or feel anything. Common drugs to be used in this setting would include Versed, which is
just going to say Versed.
It's a benzodiazepine. We've talked about it before on this show. It helps with anxiety, but it also disrupts the ability to form new memories. So it helps you forget the procedure itself. And fentanyl is another big one. So fentanyl is a synthetic opioid, which is used to treat severe pain. It's incredibly fast-acting and very potent. This is what makes it incredibly dangerous and highly addictive when it's misused. So in a controlled setting, it is used during and after procedures to treat acute pain, and it's always used with caution and very carefully kept. And most commonly, it comes in a liquid form that's given through an IV, intramuscular, or subcutaneous injection. Street drugs, most recently.
In my setting, we see it a lot in low doses of patches.
Yes, fentanyl patches.
We see patches to help with chronic pain, just giving a low dose through a patch that just kind of keeps things level.
Yeah, just transdermally, absolutely. And then street drugs are often cut with fentanyl, making product more potent, but also way more dangerous. And hundreds of thousands of fatal overdoses are attributed to fentanyl every year. Misused, it can cause respiratory depression, sedation, respiratory arrest, and death pretty easily. So it's something that is not to be taken lightly.
Right.
So very soon after he's hired, suspicious things start happening. I don't know a ton of details about specific incidents, but I do know that on three separate occasions here, he was suspected of stealing fentanyl vials and morphine vials. Multiple vials had gone missing on several different occasions. Colleagues became wary of him and his behavior, and soon after, police were actually involved in the investigation. So they start interviewing him, and he did get grilled once pretty good by police. But I understand, like, as soon as the investigation started to heat up...
the pants off of him.
Yeah. As soon as things started to heat up, he resigned. So it's unclear if the hospital, like, asked him to or pressured him to resign. Right. Or if he just left because
like
he panicked.
Sensed it coming in and got time to move on.
Exactly.
Hence why I can see why he ended up in the travel industry.
Yes, exactly. That was a great spot for what he wanted to do. And he's still like kind of a guy that likes to embellish and lie. Like he's still pretty grandiose. Neighbors noticed that he started making up stories like that he was almost drafted to the major leagues in baseball, but that he only got fired from his last job because of his DUI history.
Oh, boy.
And that neighbors also started noticing a change in behavior, too. But nobody really like suspected that he was, you know, abusing drugs. They just thought he was like going through a rough patch or whatever. So fall 2007. He suddenly packs up his stuff, grabs his dog, quick sells his house, and leaves Michigan altogether. So, I know. So,
at least he took his dog.
I mean, yeah. His dog, oh, fun fact, his dog's name was Pudge.
Hey, Pudge.
Around this time, there was a huge boom in the world of temporary healthcare staffing agencies. And this was because of the global shortage of healthcare workers. Remember when we started nursing school around this time, Devin, a couple years earlier?
There's a nursing shortage.
There's a nursing shortage. Go to nursing school, blah, blah, blah. And then we all
Fast
got out of school.
Fast forward to 2020. There's a nursing shortage.
Nursing shortage never ends.
Nope.
But actually, there was a brief like oversaturation in nurses after we got out of school.
Because everyone went to school
everybody
for
went
nursing.
To
exactly. That's not it, the way right now, thanks to the pandemic.
Exactly. So... This included...
I'd be interested to know, another side tangent, I'd be interested to know, since 2020, the enrollment numbers in nursing school.
Oh, I'd love to know. I don't know,
you know what
that
I mean?
Is. Yeah,
have
yeah.
they seen new freshman classes for, whether you're a two-year program, four-year program, whatever, but have you seen...
That's a really good
a
question.
...a decline in enrollment because of the way the pandemic has changed healthcare?
Yeah, that's an excellent
We've
question.
We've seen the retirement rates go through the roof.
Yes, we have.
Anyway.
Anyway,
if anyone has any answers to that, I'd be curious.
Devin asks the important questions around here. So, so this, you know, national shortage of healthcare workers included radiologic technologists. So these healthcare workers would sign on with an agency and pick assignments anywhere around the country where you would work for anywhere from a few weeks to, you know, several months. So these workers would then be known as travelers. So the appeal was there for employees because especially for the young and the single, you get to travel the country fully paid by the agency, get paid like
crap ton of money,
ridiculous amount of money. Mm-hmm. It's still bonkers how much you travelers make. Like, get it, folks.
Mm-hmm.
If I had the balls, I would do that, too. Mm-hmm. But I don't. And so the hiring and vetting process is left to the agency that a worker signs on with. So like their drug testing, their criminal background check is all dependent to the agency that they work with, not necessarily from the hospital that they get contracted to.
So the hospital's relying on that third party.
On the agency, exactly.
Through.
Yep. Because they technically don't work for the hospital. They work for the agency. No,
correct.
Which makes sense.
I mean, I've dealt with several traveling nurses in our field. I'm sure we all have, especially lately.
Oh, yeah. Now, drug tests were typically scheduled ahead of time. Like, you could pick your and schedule it several weeks from now. So that
something says that that's a little suspicious.
It's a little suspicious, and I don't think they do that anymore, but they used to at least. And this would like give people the opportunity, you know, and applicants to be able to like, quote, clean their system.
I got to clean out.
Got to clean out.
Drug test in 3 weeks.
And like not do drugs for a little while so that they can give a clean sample. So March 2008, within his first year as a traveler, his behavior at a hospital in Pittsburgh, PA starts raising some eyebrows. And at this time, he was under contract with the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and he was seen walking into an operating room, which he thought was empty, immediately lifting up his shirt and revealing a syringe tucked into his waistband.
What?
The co-worker was immediately suspicious and reported the incident. So what was interesting about the syringe is that many procedural areas in the hospital would use fentanyl in pre-filled syringes, meaning it's pre-packaged in a syringe in metered doses, ready to go. And this way, you know, it improves efficiency because it eliminates the few minutes of time needed to measure and draw up your own dose. And it also helps to, you know, control medication errors and adverse events from overdrawing the amount. So they often order these syringes, which are very clearly labeled with the drug that's on the inside. So when that nurse saw that syringe in his waistband, she immediately recognized it was a fentanyl syringe.
Okay.
So during an investigation...
I mean, it's suspicious enough to see someone hiding a syringe in the waistband of their scrubs.
Well, exactly. But she
but
saw
then when
it,
you recognize
she
what
saw
it is.
And she was like, that's a freaking fentanyl syringe. Are you shitting me? So during the investigation, apparently they were able to retrieve the syringe that he was seen with and found that the liquid inside was not fentanyl at all. And it was another clear substance, normal saline.
Was it a fentanyl syringe, like still labeled?
So it was still labeled as a fentanyl syringe, but it was another clear substance, normal saline. The two are visibly indistinguishable. They're both clear liquids. So you would never tell to look at it if the liquid had been replaced with something. This is the first reported time that he was suspected of using the medication swap tactic that he would use for like years to come. So it appeared that what he was doing was attaching a needle to the syringe, injecting himself with the drug, and then drawing up normal saline with that same needle to put back in the syringe to make it appear as though it was a full syringe of fentanyl, and then restocking it for patient use, which...
effed up.
Exactly. As a result, first off, other staff...
They're not getting their pain control for the patient.
Not getting the medicine that they so desperately need. And then secondly, by using the needle he stuck into his arm to draw saline and sterile water up after, he was completely contaminating the saline that would end up inside the syringe or the vial with his body fluids.
Hence how he contaminated these people.
Exactly. So this would have been disgusting even if he were not already infected with a blood-borne pathogen, but he was.
Oh,
hepatitis C.
Damn.
So hepatitis C is a chronic viral infection which causes inflammation of the liver. It can lead to serious liver damage. And this is a blood-borne pathogen. We all learn about it, and we all have to do studies about it because it's one of those things that as a healthcare worker, we are at risk for being exposed to
on a day-to-day basis.
Right. And it can take even years to actually manifest any symptoms. Many people are found to have hepatitis C sort of by accident during routine medical workups. So it is commonly transmitted via sharing needles with an infected person for illicit drug use. Contaminated, that's the most common way to get it. Mm-hmm. They've actually more recently too seen it with intranasal. Like if you use intranasal drugs, intranasal cocaine, that can be transmitted that way as well.
Wow.
It's also transmitted through contaminated tattoo equipment or piercing equipment. Mm-hmm. If your mother was Hep C positive when she gave birth to you, that could expose you during infancy. Mm-hmm. Also, if you received a blood transfusion or organ transplant before 1992, if you haven't already been tested, you should get tested, people. It can cause things like easy bruising or bleeding, fatigue, poor appetite, jaundice, which is a yellow discoloration to the skin and eyes. Yep. Skin itching, fluid retention, weight loss, confusion, and then ultimately lead to liver failure and liver cancer. Mm. Hepatitis C is actually treatable and even curable now with medications these days.
If it's treated early.
And it's an intense treatment program. It's usually headed up by a specialized gastroenterologist. And it takes, you know, weeks to months of medication therapy to eradicate the virus. But if it's not diagnosed until liver damage is done, the damage is typically irreversible and can even cause liver failure or progress to liver cancer, which can be fatal. So by mixing tiny bits of his blood in with the saline solution into these syringes, he's transmitting the virus into these syringes and vials, which are then being injected directly into patients.
And by putting right back where they were, you're thinking that it's fentanyl that
Anybody would look at it and say it's a stocked fentanyl syringe. It's ready for use. So they do this whole big investigation, right? And then later they found an empty morphine syringe and three more empty fentanyl syringes on his person and in his locker.
On his person.
Mm-hmm.
Who found this?
So, officials during an investigation. I'm not positive exactly who. Yep. So, as soon as they found this, he was immediately escorted to the ER for an on-the-spot drug test.
Good.
He tested positive for fentanyl and morphine metabolites, and he was terminated on the spot. His staffing agency was notified immediately.
That was my next question.
Yes. So, despite the overwhelming evidence from the investigation, the hospital did not report him to the police. In addition, neither did the staffing agency. In fact, his agency, Maxim, kept him on and reassigned him to a different place months later.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
Hold on.
Okay.
Fine. You don't get reported to the police.
Fine.
Which you should.
Yes, but fine.
But fine. You don't. They don't report it to the Department of Health, the Board of Radiology Tech. What?
Nothing.
They don't even try to get him into. I mean, I would. I know they have them now, but they have the drug diversion programs for, and they have
none.
So, did anything occur?
He got a new job.
Stop it.
Yeah. I swear to God.
Not even, like, a write-up?
I mean, he got fired.
Okay, come on!
But for his agency, I don't know that anything disciplinary happened. Apparently not, because he retained his job.
The staffing agency doesn't exist anymore, right? Because, like you said in the beginning, the hospitals are relying on these people to do their job.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I think they still are in existence. It's ridiculous.
Because it's, especially when you're a staffing agency, you're not just like HR for one hospital.
I know. So, on paper, I mean, his resume actually looked great.
Of course, because they forgot about his drug abuse and his stolen syringes and his positive drug test. So on paper, he looks great.
He looks great if you just don't mention any of that shit.
It's like, it's almost like you're handed like one of those CIA files where you have all the code words blacked out.
Mm-hmm.
So here's my resume. Ignore everything in the black.
Yeah. If you
that
would.
Stuff doesn't matter.
No, none of that matters.
None of that matters. Just pay attention to what's not blacked out.
Yeah. Just read, you know, really between the lines, like for real. Isn't this crazy? This is wild. It's wild to me. So he goes on to work in a few different hospitals from there, including a Baltimore, Virginia. Baltimore, Virginia?
Maryland.
Thank you.
We're making up cities.
We are. So
there's probably a Baltimore, Virginia, and it's a tiny, small, little, quaint town.
Is there? We want to hear about it.
Let's Google it.
Okay. She's Googling it. So what I meant to say was that he worked in a Baltimore VA hospital, and I just can't read.
But yeah, that's why you said Virginia.
That's why I said Virginia. And a place called Advanced Med, which is based in Frisco, Texas, both of which actually gave him really good references and cited absolutely no issues when he worked there. It might have been that he was just learning to be less sloppy and more careful while he was there.
There's a New Baltimore, Virginia.
Is there? Oh my God, are any of you guys from New Baltimore?
It's a census-designated place in Virginia.
Yay!
Population in 2010 of 8,100 people.
That's relatively small. Hi, New Baltimore. We love you.
Unincorporated community. See, I said a very small, quaint little
town.
How
do you know these? What's happening?
I'm a miracle worker.
You pretty much are. So he keeps getting these travel contracts, and many of these hospitals would either give him like a neutral reference or not comment at all. And this was thought to be because up to this point, he hadn't been formally charged with anything. And if he hadn't been formally charged, he could have sued them for giving him a poor reference based on unfounded charges.
But you have a positive drug test.
Oh, yeah.
That's still something.
Yeah, but no charges were ever brought. So I know. Dumb. So he transitions in spring of 2010 after another half dozen travel assignments to a staffing agency called Springboard. And he began an assignment through Springboard working for Arizona Heart Hospital. Now, at Arizona Heart Hospital, it only took 2 weeks before a crisis happened there. David was found 2 weeks into his employment there.
2 weeks.
Unresponsive in the men's bathroom. His breathing was shallow and slow. He had an injection mark in his inner elbow. And floating in the toilet was an empty, pre-filled fentanyl syringe. So he was, of course, taken to the ER, probably Narcan'd. Upon waking, he reportedly blurted out, "I am going to jail." You're not wrong.
I'm fucked.
I'm so fucked.
Not like, thanks for saving my life.
Nope, I am so fucked.
But wait a minute. Let me guess. He doesn't go to jail.
Not yet. This is not where the story ends.
No,
the story
it comes to New Hampshire first.
Yes, exactly.
So, I'm guessing like 2012.
You're exactly right. Wow.
Was I? I was trying to think because I remember where I worked when I heard this story.
It was 2012.
Like, I feel like it was around 2012.
Yep. So he tells hospital officials that I was in a Crohn's crisis and I grabbed the fentanyl to inject myself to alleviate my pain. I've never done this before. And when asked why, he like told this sob story about being like stupid and it was a lapse in judgment and et cetera. And so the police were called to the hospital. However, it appears that no charges were actually filed. Because he talked his way out of it.
Come again?
No charges were actually filed because he's a charming motherfucker that spun this as a one-off incident. When in fact he had been doing this for a long time.
I'm just going to keep staring.
Okay. After his staffing agency was notified of this incident, Springboard did notify the National Registry of Radiologic Technologists.
Oh, good.
Which is his certifying body. So yeah. Apparently, there was an investigation which did not lead to any disciplinary action, and he retained his certification after he passed a drug test.
But does this stay on a record, the report?
I don't know. It just led to no disciplinary action, and he kept his license.
Which is bullshit anyway.
Or his certification through the certifying body. He did, however, voluntarily surrender his state license in the state of Arizona only, which meant he's not able to work in that role in Arizona, but like,
he's a traveler. There's like 49 other states he could go to.
There's literally so many other states. Doesn't restrict him anywhere else in the U.S.
Wow.
So from there, he goes on to work in facilities in Kansas, Georgia, and actually in Georgia, he had a brief relationship with a nurse who declined to be named so she didn't get dragged into all of like the criminal investigation.
How nice of him.
I know. But she later reported that she often saw him like in pain and that he regularly drank to excess to like cope with the pain. Like he was he had Crohn's, so I'm sure he was in a lot of pain like regularly. But she had no idea that he was abusing drugs. And in April of 2011, He's hired by Triage Staffing Agency, despite his troubled past. Not sure how he got by on that one. He was immediately assigned to an assignment in Exeter, New Hampshire at Exeter Hospital. So hospital officials later stated that they relied heavily on the staffing agency's vetting of him, as they always do, and that his credentials were all intact. He had lots of positive references and records of past drug tests, so nothing really raised red flags. Lots of
positives.
Yeah. Remember, he'd worked in a lot of places where he did get good feedback, because I think there were times where he was being very careful and very mindful, and he was flying under the radar. Hmm. And he was a hard worker, and he was very charming. Mm-hmm. So this role that he got a job for was pretty specialized that he was working in. He was specifically recruited to work in the cardiac catheterization lab. So the cardiac catheterization is a highly specialized procedure performed by an interventional cardiologist. Patients who have heart attacks, heart valve disease, or heart failure will undergo this procedure. And simply put, the patient is given some conscious sedation and pain relief through the IV. The cardiologist will access the patient's major vessels with a thin, flexible catheter, typically either via the femoral arteries in the groin or the radial arteries in the wrist. They then thread this catheter all the way up through and towards their heart, injecting a special radiopaque dye directly into the coronary arteries. And a radiologic technologist plays a very important role here, because they are the ones operating the X-ray and CT technology to take real-time images and video of the dye traveling through the vessels
where the cardiologist can see.
Exactly. So the cardiologist can locate specific areas in the vessels that are narrow and sometimes open them up using a small balloon or place a small mesh tube called a stent in to hold it open. So it's a very super technical procedure, and it's fascinating to watch. It's so fun. This position had some long, grueling hours. There were call responsibilities. So, like, if somebody was having, like, a massive heart attack or a STEMI, he would have to come in the middle of the night and assist with that procedure. So it seemed for a while that his personal life was, like, maybe starting to turn around a little. Like, he lived with this roommate that he later said was making, like, a ton of money in this assignment. He started spending a lot of time in the gym and eating really healthy, and he was getting a lot of attention from girls. He did continue to spread, like, weird stuff about himself, like that he had this fiance, which he was engaged once, and she broke up with him, but he was telling everybody that she died in a car wreck. What? Just, like, stupid shit like that.
Trying to play the sympathy card or something?
Well, that's the thing. Like, just trying to, like, create this narrative about himself, which is just so dumb. Like, just stop, dude.
Make up things.
Yeah, cut it out. So despite this, though, his colleagues all reported that he was very good at his job, and he took it very seriously in the beginning, and everybody really liked him. His roommate stated that one night she was helping him out by doing some of his laundry, and then she found a few needles in his laundry.
Oh, boy.
She did approach him about it, and he stated, "Oh, those are for my cancer treatments."
Huh?
And this struck her as odd, because the pair were pretty close. He had never mentioned cancer, which it turned out, of course, he did not have. Mm-hmm. But she, you know, gave him the benefit of the doubt and was like, "Okay, dude, like, yeah, what, you know,
but,
okay.
You know, like, it's my opinion, and it's a strong opinion, that if you find needles where needles are not supposed to be, it's usually a sign.
I mean,
or it is a sign.
You would think. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Agreed. Completely. So while in New Hampshire, he also did get a tattoo for, like, the national symbol of, like, Crohn's disease. Like, he got, like, a tattoo. You know how people, like, get, like, you know, the little ribbon for, like, mm-hmm. breast cancer and mm-hmm. stuff? I guess there's a similar symbol for, like, for Crohn's disease. So he got, like, a tattoo of it. So coworkers started noticing that he would kind of, like, sway at times, like he was unsteady on his feet. And initially they were kind of concerned for his health, because they all knew that he had Crohn's, and he would just say, "Oh yeah, you know, I've just been kind of sick lately. Like, my Crohn's is kind of acting up."
His Crohn's and his cancer.
Mm-hmm. He would often, like, rush to the bathroom, stating he was sick, and was observed, like, sweating heavily on numerous occasions and just, like, looking generally unwell. To me, it kind of sounds like he was withdrawing a little
bit.
Yeah. So the time comes in May of that year where he was nearing the end of this stint at Exeter Hospital. And he had stated that his next plans were to return to his home state of Michigan. But around that time, suddenly the Exeter area is plagued with a sudden outbreak of hepatitis C. Several patients had tested positive, and providers pretty quickly realized that each and every one of these patients had passed through the cardiac cath lab at Exeter Hospital for a procedure recently.
So not just at that hospital, at the cardiac cath lab.
Cardiac cath lab at that hospital, yes.
Wow.
Interestingly, all of these patients had a very specific genotype of hepatitis C. There are 6 known different genotypes of hep C. Some are much more common than others. These patients all had a more uncommon strain of hepatitis C. So,
in telling them that it's from one source.
From one source, yeah. Most likely, exactly. Yeah. So, in response, all the staff in the cath lab and hundreds of previous patients were mandated to be tested.
Wow.
30 total patients ended up testing positive for this strain of hepatitis C. And only one employee tested positive. And it was...
David
Kwiatkowski. So in April of 2012, after all of this investigation had completed, he was finally arrested and charged with 14 counts of tampering with a consumer product and illegally obtaining drugs.
Why only 14?
I think they probably just could not physically connect him
to all 30.
To all of them, like through physical evidence, because right. It had happened so long ago.
Yeah.
So on a review of his medical records, it looked like he initially tested positive in 2010. So he did what he did knowing full well that
he had
a bloodborne pathogen and he was contaminating all of those vials and syringes doing what he was doing, which is just fucking disgusting. He pled guilty to all 14 counts, avoiding a trial altogether.
Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that he had known he was infected for much of his time doing this is what drove his sentencing. And he was sentenced to 39 years in prison for being responsible for a large hepatitis C outbreak.
Good.
Which I feel like is good.
Yeah.
I would, you know what I mean? Like, sometimes you feel like, you know, the justice system actually does what's appropriate. And I feel like this is one of those times.
Thank
Although it should have been longer.
But you're getting almost enough, 40 years.
But I'm happy that he got what he did, because it seems like with the charge being what it is, that it would have been less, but
You've
it's
got
not.
People that have been, like, full-on murdered.
Exactly.
Not by a disease.
Getting
or
less
whatever.
Time and, than yeah. this. Exactly. So months pass. More and more patients are testing positive. So
outside of just New Hampshire.
Yep. So the total in New Hampshire looked to be 32. There were 6 in Kansas. There was 1 in Maryland.
Wow.
But he had worked at a total of 18 hospitals
My
in
gosh.
7 states. So the actual number is unknown.
Right.
Like, right now, the traceable total is 46 positive cases linked directly to him. So
wow.
The most recent news to come out of this was that in July of 2021, he sought compassionate release from prison due to COVID-19 and his
Stop
ongoing
it.
Medical issues. Yes, he did. He stated that because I have Crohn's disease and I'm on immunotherapies, it puts me at a higher risk for severe COVID, which is probably true.
True. But how about all the people that are dealing with hepatitis in the community during COVID-19?
So thankfully he had a judge that was like, nope.
Yeah.
So at his hearing, he apologized to the victims and their families. He stated that his crimes were driven largely by his addiction to painkillers and alcohol. He never meant to hurt anybody, which, like, fuck you. You were being so reckless. Like, you
That's,
knew.
He was being very negligent.
Yes, exactly.
Especially by, like, here's the thing. He could have just been taking the fentanyl.
Yeah.
He replaced it with saline and put it back on the shelf.
To stay undetected. And
right.
He's a medical professional.
He knew
professional.
That
he
was
going to
go into somebody.
He knew that he was contaminating
yeah.
those
That's
vials.
Negligence.
He knew it. Mm-hmm. So... he said he never meant to hurt anyone, however, and he did state that he was having, like, this mental breakdown at the time of his arrest, and that he should never have been allowed to plead guilty, and that he did so under duress, which,
I should
like,
never
what?
Have been done the right thing.
Shut up,
never.
Dude. So blah, blah, blah. Lots of like sob story, lots of, you know,
had he not,
poor
he
me.
Probably would have gotten more than 39
exactly.
years. I mean, that's probably why it's also not more too, because
exactly.
he did confess. We
yes.
all know that. You plead
exactly.
guilty, they go a little less. You're still mm-hmm. going to get punished.
Exactly.
But he probably would have gotten life.
Exactly.
I would have imagined.
Yes. So the judge hearing this case was U.S. Attorney John Farley, and he wanted none of this shit.
Denied.
He said that you destroyed 46 lives by right. infecting them with potentially deadly disease.
Uh-huh.
And he was denied compassionate release. Yahoo. He can have all the COVID.
You get COVID. You get COVID.
Yes. I couldn't actually find the name of the prison that he's in right now, but he's actually in prison somewhere in Florida, which seems weird.
Why?
I don't know. I don't even know that he ever went to Florida. He might have done an assignment in Florida that I just didn't see.
Hmm.
But I don't know. He's in Florida. Mm. So I just want to close out with this. So there's a 65-year-old former Army surgeon by the name of Linwood Nelson, who was among the very first to have been infected by Kwiatkowski. He unfortunately did suffer liver damage from the hepatitis C, which he lives with to this day. He has been quoted to say, quote, "I've learned not to trust everyone who wears scrubs and a hospital ID," end quote. Mm. Which is like so sad for the rest of us who just
it
show
so
up every day.
It is so sad for all of us that are doing our
and
jobs
genuinely
the way we should
be. Just want to fucking help people
but
every day.
On the other end, you can't blame them. Look at this show. We wouldn't have had, we wouldn't
God,
have this
no.
show if it weren't for them.
We want to expose all of you.
Disgrace,
we will slowly expose all of you for being shitbags.
They disgrace the good name of those that
yes.
work in healthcare
it
to do
really
the right
thing. It
really
devalues what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Keep mm-hmm. the value going.
Thank you for listening, everyone. Patreons, thank you for picking this.
Yes, this was such a good one. I'm really glad you picked it.
I was secretly hoping for this one.
I actually was, too. And it does not mean that we are not going to cover the other ones.
Oh,
the
we're
other
totally
ones
going
are
to.
Amazing cases. We just wanted to kind of give you guys the pick of what we did first.
The other ones are totally coming.
They are coming, baby.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if you want to keep following us, you can check us out on Instagram at MedCrimesPodcast.
Tweet at us at MedCrimesPC.
You can find us on the good old Facebook Ooh. At MedCrimesPodcast.
If you wish to become a Patreon, you can visit us at www.patreon.com/MedCrimesPodcast.
You can still send us your crazy ass stories.
If
ask
you,
us any questions.
If you are from New Baltimore, Virginia, I want you to email me directly and I will literally answer you immediately.
If any of the 8,100 people that live there are listening to this show,
please, I want
to
know.
Please reach out to us, medcrimes@gmail.com.
We love you guys. Stay safe. Mwah.
Bye-bye.